up with the stated policy goal of achieving an international agreement which stabilises emissions at 450 ppm. As Dustin pointed out, 450 ppm still has serious risks. Just to do a couple of things on the climate side, so the main goal for energy is just to remind us of generally what the fight for the purpose is. Stabilising emissions at 450 ppm would see a loss of 20-30% of all species. Would see half the population of the world face water shortages. 450 ppm can avoid some of those. 450 ppm might avoid the Great Barrier Reef disappearing. It probably won't avoid Kakadu wetlands being adversely affected. About 80% of the wetlands there will be subject to saltwater intrusion. Probably won't avoid some of the impacts on areas like World Heritage areas in the wet tropics in the far north, where 2 degree temperature rise there, we see every single Australian endemic vertebrate in that area be forced to extinction. So that's focusing on the environmental side of things, but obviously some very real human impacts out there. So I don't see how we've actually concretely say that Australia is actually arguing for an international agreement that it avoids dangerous climate change with the weak targets that have been outlined. Those of you who know me also know that I've been working on emissions trading for 5 or more years now, and we did put in a 70-page submission to the CPRS and have you talk about the rest of the details and why we think there's been way too many handouts to the big blues here as well. But yeah, that's in a nutshell. We're certainly still recovering from the shock of the time.
Okay, now look, before we open it up, maybe if we could go around each of the speakers. Starting with Steve, just 2 minutes, 1 minute on what's missing, what's next.
I'll respond to some of the things, and I'll try and keep it to 2 minutes. Frank asked a question about what are we doing. Okay, I think there are two separable issues that's important to keep in mind. Okay, one is building the capacity to deliver a low carbon future for Australia. That's about the design integrity of the scheme. And both my professional view, and I have to say, and my personal view, as somebody who's been in this game for a while, I think the scheme stacks up very well against those criteria, and we can talk more. The second issue is where you want to go with the scheme, and that's the target issue, and I hope the targets evolve over time. But I will criticise Regina when she said that she thought Australia's targets were too low to avoid damage to climate change, without taking account of Frank's slide that basically said Australia's targets are broadly comparable with all the other targets on the table. So I'm happy for people to say Australia's targets are too weak. I'm not. Well, my Australian donor position is I think it's inconsistent to say Australia's targets are too weak and everybody else's are okay. So you can criticise the global community, and that's a fair cop, but the global community's targets on Frank's suggestion are in the order 550 to 500. Other people will argue that we need to do much better than that. The Prime Minister would be in that group. We've stated that Australia's national interest is 450 or lower, and that it's not easy to get there. So I'll leave it there.
Okay, look, I'm actually going to take a class in this. This is a really big issue, this population one, that has not, in a sense, gone over, completely glossed over, and then that's been picked up in the announcement. I'd like to make a couple of points. One is that it's Australia's choice to have rapid population growth, primarily, by running a very high immigration program. That's the main driver. Okay, so that is our choice.
Are you saying that if we didn't have high population growth, that our emissions would be the same?
Look, the argument that our emission effort is comparable is, as Frank pointed out, based on this metric of the per capita reduction. Okay, that's what Graham means, that we have a comparable reduction in per capita.
No, I'm not referring to that. I'm referring to Frank's slide, which was what the Garno modelling assumed in its trajectories for different countries. That wasn't justified on per capita basis. It was the Garno.
What I'm referring to is it's known as Table E1 in the web, in summary of the white paper, and you pick out of Garno where you've got 5 to 15, and you've got a column showing absolute levels of reduction, 5 to 15% compared to 20%. Okay, compared to for the UK is or 20 to 30 is the comparable, because Europe's depending up to 30 in the unit. So 5 to 15 compared to 20 to 30 compared to 26 to 32 is the UK one. In the middle column, it's then shown to be relatively comparable effort as a per capita reduction, because you built in this 45% growth in population between 1990 and 2020 in Australia, compared to no real significant growth in Europe. And so those numbers become more equivalent, taking into account population growth. In other words, Australia gets rewarded for population growth. What this gets back to is a debate that we have to have, that the original contraction and convergence idea involved a base year for population, on the argument that reducing emissions, a strategy in reducing emissions was reducing population growth. And China has argued, for example, very strongly that its efforts to limit its population growth have been a major contributor to emissions being lower than they would otherwise have been. So all I'm saying is that is an issue that has not really been debated. Implicit in Australia's position now is that population growth gets rewarded with a higher target.
That's my point. The statement I'm making, that we can come up with at least six different ways of comparing effort. I think it's unquestionable that you can argue that Australia is, Frank's conclusion I think is right, that Australia is in the leading group.
Yeah.
And I just want to make a distinction between whether Australia is doing, what it's doing compared to the rest of the world, and the distinction between that and whether what the world as a whole is talking about is enough. And I think they're separate issues and we shouldn't confuse them, because it doesn't help for Australia.
Yeah, but
I think what happens there is you get into this discussion of which is the morally adequate comparator over effort, right? And there's no solution to this debate. And I think there's at least two people in the audience who want to speak to this. But where this ends up is just in an argument over ethics. And that's really the problem that you're going to be facing at the international level as well. Now, the saving grace is that a lot of these different metrics actually show you sort of roughly a similar order of magnitude, right? So you can take many different comparators of effort, and they're all going to tell you that it looks like those countries that look like making a commitment seem to be making a 550 type commitment, right? And really, that's where it comes back together at the end, and where perhaps there's some hope for some agreement, right, in the negotiations going forward. But at the same time, everyone's kind of talking about 450 or possibly 350, and a really big challenge will be to make that jump collectively, because it will not happen individually as individual nation states, to something that has some true significant effort at going beyond, carbon prices of $40 a pound.
We'll take a couple of
questions. Yeah, I'm here from Greenbank. Frank, although I agree with your heartfelt sentiment on the 45% population growth, I thought you were actually to be the moderator of the panel speaking.
Sorry?
I thought you were to be the moderator,
yeah,
not the speaker.
Well, no, I'm sorry.
So
I would be interested
to hear what the panel had to say.
Does that mean we can speak? Is there another question?
No.
Well, I was hoping to come back to the issue of the role of renewable energy, because I thought the presentations have been a bit one-sided. And, I mean, realistically, if you look at the longer term, the needs for making Australia a low-carbon economy, then it makes sense to invest now, on a large scale, in both renewable energy and in energy efficiency. And the reason is simply that if we have a scheme that basically puts most of the resources into gas, a lot of that gas is going to be gone by 2050. It's a diversion, it's a waste of money. Gas is very useful as a backup to renewable energy. But to actually go for the marginal approach, I think is a big mistake. I also want to just argue that basically we could get very big contributions from both energy efficiency, solar and water, and renewable sources of electricity before 2020, despite the claims of the coal and the nuclear supporters here. For a start, energy efficiency and solar hot water with the right kind of incentives can actually reduce the demand for base load considerably in this country. Then in renewable energy before 2020, we have quite a good potential from bioelectricity, from residues of existing crops, and we will see significant contributions from solar thermal with storage and geothermal before 2020. These are much less speculative technologies than CCS. Wind power, with a little bit of peak load backup, can actually substitute for quite significant amounts of coal power. It's no different from the Danish situation, where the backup comes over the grid from Norway and Germany. Similarly, in Australia, we don't have an intercontinental grid, but a bit of additional gas turbines, and we've done some of the modelling already quite some years ago, and some hydro. With that wind peak load combination, you can have a system that's just as reliable as a coal-fired power. So if you add it all up, by 2020, I suggest wind could supply 10% of our electricity, and the other renewables, bioelectricity and solar thermal and geothermal, the remaining 10%, and with some solar as well in there. So we could probably get 25% renewable target. I really think it's possible. The problem is, as a lot of the speakers have indicated, the policies are all wrong. The policies aren't going to do it. The CPRS isn't going to do it. We need to boost wind. We need an expanded renewable energy target at one end for the lower cost of renewables. And we need policies to get solar up as quickly as possible, which probably means feed-in tariffs. But there's little indication that these things are going to happen. And although Steve said, yes, we're going to have this expanded mandatory renewable energy target, the reality is that it's not going to be implemented before 2010. And it could have been implemented this year.
Quick response is the.
Can I respond directly to that issue? Having done a lot of lobbying in Canberra, one of the things that we were assured by, you know, Treasury and Finance and so on about the role of the CBRS in terms of its the significance, this role of it being 80%, is that the forward price would provide the technology pull through. Now, forward price, which is capped at $40, or even now we're seeing probably at an international CER price of 26, maybe 30, is not enough to allow anyone to invest in major technologies. So that would mean that that's not going to happen. Now, in order to get deep cuts of, you know, consistent with 450, you have to have a very diversified supply of zero and low emission technologies and energy efficiency. So the energy efficiency you could expect will get pulled through. Your diversification on your supply side won't. Now, we're seeing exactly the same thing coming up with the new REC, because the economists in Canberra will be telling us that the most economically efficient REC is to have it technology neutral. Technology neutral means you pick one technology, which is the first over the line, probably wind, maybe a bit of biomass. If solar thermal's in, that's what you'll get. What are they? Existing commercial technologies. So you won't get a diversified pool of technologies that you need to position the company, so to position the country for a low carbon economy in the period 2030 to 2050. And I think this is this point about the difference between an economist and an industrialist, is that the short term position of least cost is not actually delivering the industrial diversity that you need for 2050. And that means that you pay for it later, because you end up with a very poor scheme which has fewer players than if you pull those industries and those technologies in. So I think the same argument we're seeing on CPRS we'll see played out in January and February on the REC. And if we see a similar outcome, it may unfortunately, we have a very undiversified industry.
Okay, Alan, and then Steve, and then we'll go back.
If you were an economic purist, we thought the current price arriving out of the CPRS was somehow optimal, was deterministic, or was the carbon price to be relied on forever, you wouldn't have a REC. You'd think the shadow price of the carbon from the carbon price from the CPRS is all you need. If you're a bit more cautious about how Australia interacts with the rest of the world, and you recognise that, trying to avoid techo language, it's asymmetric. If you, there's a degree of party dependence. So one explanation of what the REC is doing is it's deliberately on a particular sector imposing a higher shadow price of carbon now. Okay, so for renewables, we're pulling forward renewable investments that would not otherwise occur. That, you can measure that, you can put millions of dollars net present value cost against that. That's cost over and above what you would have with the REC. What that's doing, though, is it's hedging against a future with higher carbon prices that we desperately hope for. Okay, we haven't got that carbon price now. We're not imposing that carbon price across the whole of the economy. And in terms of the sequencing of investment decisions in the electricity sector, we're pulling forward renewables now and deferring some gas as a way of managing the hoped-for risk of long-run carbon price. I could talk more about where the CPRS plays in, but I'll just leave it that.
But see, then why put the caps on the price? If you want to pull forward the investment, and you're also phasing out REC fairly quickly.
One way of thinking about the broader scheme issue is, at one hand, there are a group of people who say the signal we wish to send to the world is that Australia is willing to embrace now 25% target reduction for 2020. There is a potential other signal that we could send to the world that Australia tried to do this and failed to get it through Parliament. And, you know, thus another case study in failed ambition. Okay? We need to be very careful about which signal we send to the world, and at the moment we're sending neither of those, I hope.
Okay.
I just about what Australia's effort is in health. You know, we've got a 15% target or a 5% target, or a 15%, then based on a per capita basis, like if China based its emissions on per capita, they can increase their emissions four times and still be under the target. I mean, it is a very dangerous process, and Australia is the only country I've seen base it on an emission on per capita growth. But anyway, apart from that, if what did Australia ask for the global issue? We just had a meeting in Poznan. As far as I can say, Australia did not push for harder targets for the whole of the industrialised world. What has Australia pushed for? You know, were we out at the front saying we've got to take strong targets? And I didn't see that.
Okay, well, just another one over here.
John Whalen, I'm a manufacturer in Newcastle. I've been bits of steel. I walked the factory floor. We hate compliance. We've got compliance up to here. What I'd like to ask is, or suggest to you, is that with one stroke, you could get me off the grid. And that is give me a better tax deduction for a solar panel on the roof of 4,000 square metres. And it's not discussed anywhere. Nowhere does anybody talk about the incentive for tax deduction scheme. Grants are useless. Grants take $80,000 to fill in the form. But I suggest to Conservation Council and other people that if somebody could start talking about tax deductibility for putting in better sustainable energy use, we'd do it tomorrow. A wind farm in France is deductible in the year it's installed. Here it's 20 years. And putting in a solar panel, no accountant can tell me how long I get the tax deduction for. I just manufacture. But I do talk to Tomago, and I do talk to OneSteel, and I do talk to all the polluters, and I don't speak for them, but I want to tell you, they think the people in Canberra are in La La Land.
I might, because Steve has some time in Treasury, I might come to him, but I do make the observation that the tax deductibility route has obviously been a very major policy lever in the US as well, and much of the original development of renewables came back to both investment and later production tax credits, although there were some debacles too. the early tax deductibility for water heaters set that industry back in the US. But in Canberra, it's not seen as a very good policy measure, and I can understand some of those arguments, but do you want to comment?
A more general comment about some of this stuff is, and we saw some of it in the presentation, the presumption that measurable change in behaviour is the goal. Okay? We think the goal is, you know, fair, competitive, efficient, genuinely low emission future. Okay, so the IEA, when they evaluate the German feeding tariff, which lots of people think is fabulous, their conclusion is the feeding tariff costs 30 to 50 times more money per unit of abatement than the next best option. Okay? We want to achieve 30 to 50 times more abatement by choosing the most efficient strategy.
The question I have is about the complementary schemes like the expanded RET. It's okay to talk about we're going to have this target, but a whole raft of engineering issues, issues with the AER, regulatory price determinations, that could jack up prices on what consumers and businesses pay. That just, I mean, I haven't read the reports, I've been travelling the last couple of days, but it's okay to say to have 20%, but there's been no consideration for the engineering difficulties, how many gigawatts you're actually going to a shortfall because the intensity of how much you can get out of renewables is nowhere near what you can get out of combustible coal sources, brown or black. It's just for end users, they're constantly having to back and pay to drive to when the government should be putting up the bill because it's their policy decision. It's just not good enough.
Sorry, just on that point, I'll tell you one of the biggest issues for delivering long term. There's a shortage of 28,000 engineers in Australia today. So if you expect to have, I mean, they've been talking about carbon as the third industrial revolution. So that assumes you've got to get a lot of industry going. And where the hell have you got the engineers? Because you can't pull them out of nowhere. And this again is this issue that when you put in a price, industry will jump. Well, the price of oil has gone through the roof, and industry had a hell of a lot of trouble jumping because there aren't engineers, there isn't the equipment, and it takes a long time to bring things to market. So on the one hand, that's a very fair point, but on the other hand, if you want that to happen over the coming four decades, you're going to have to get it rolling. As Frank maybe said, you've got to break the catch-22. Someone's got to break the catch-22, and you have to start that rolling. And the one thing I would, in terms of this REP, because I think there's probably a consensus that that's going to become very, very important now, is the implication of a diversified REP. The UK have decided to abandon a neutral approach and go with a banded approach because they want to pull through lots of technologies, and they've realised it's not an abatement game. Again, Steve, the feed-in tariff is not about abatement in the short term. It's about abatement in the long term. It's about getting those industries up and running. Because you can't suddenly in 2040 or 2030 say, we want it overnight. You can't do it. It's too big. So if you want it, you've got to get those industries rolling now. And I agree completely that will take time to get those moving.
It's a matter of who pays. And again, it's the household aren't going to pay because their assistance package and a $2 to $5 increase in electricity charges is not a price signal for them to adjust their behaviour. It's just non-existent. And a lot of the industry guys are agreeing with me, retailers and generators, they're all agreeing with this. And it's just a matter of who pays. And if electricity sector is the big, we all know it's the most responsible, most emissions, it has the more cost than any other sector to reduce Australia's carbon emissions into the atmosphere. Again, with all of the assistance that's going on to ET industries, it's again the whole focus of who pays falls on a small group of people who are continually over the years having to pay to drive government decisions, and that's just really unfair, and they're all saying.
I'll make a point on some of the observations about some of these questions. What I've noticed in Canberra, there is a real battle of how do we get the emissions trading scheme into place. Now, it was a commitment of the government when they came in to introduce emissions trading. That was one of their goals. They had to get in place. Now, the question is how they do that
and how they get agreement through the Senate, because they don't have the Senate. They have to get agreement with someone. They're also very cognizant that the Australian people, as much as every survey will say we support emissions trading, we support reducing the impact of CO2. If jobs get cut, people start losing money, people start hitting the back pocket. The desire for change will dry up, and people will say, no, this hurts too much. What I've seen in Canberra is the Labor government has been forced to focus a scheme that will gain the support of the coalition to make it through the Senate. Basically because what's being asked on the other side really jeopardises the successful implementation of the scheme. Now, successful is not just about the abatement target you set, but public support for the scheme. You really have to look, if you want a emissions trading scheme, after 5 years of implementation, people say, hey, that worked. Hasn't been a big disaster, lights are still on, hasn't cost them too much. What happens next? Now, if you set big targets, especially with banking in this, right at the word go, the Australian economy cannot start and cope. We just can't afford it. So our little space here is if you keep on saying we want minus 40% cuts by 2020, minus 25% cuts, what you actually do is lose the ability to put an emissions trading scheme in the first place and lose any chance of doing anything. Now, what we're probably going to see is a fairly soft scheme to start with that can get coalition support. And maybe, after that, if it proves successful, that is when people should start saying, now's the time to ratchet up your targets. Now's the time to ratchet up your goals. Because if you go hard to start with, you'll lose a lot of people, and the thing will fail. If you want to fight climate change, this emissions trading scheme cannot fail. It has to be perceived as a success by everybody.
Okay, Paul.
Just briefly, some response to that. I mean, I actually teach a course here at UNSW on environmental markets, and I think it's important to, I mean, there's a lot of debate here about the usefulness of emissions trading or an NREG type of instrument. I think it's important to separate the use of those instruments from the design you end up with through the political process. And I think, I mean, you asked the question, what's missing? I mean, from lecturing that, and I guess being a lawyer who works in this space, I support the use of market-based instruments like that to achieve these outcomes. But I must admit, having seen the process over the last year, I think that the government's gone too far in terms of what they're trying to cover with the emissions trading scheme. And I think the lack of focus on the complementary measures around that has been a real failing of this government. And I think the reason for that is that they inherited a scheme design that came out of Treasury under Howard and very much coming from a theoretical position of designing the most broad scheme that you could that would really be, as it stands, the most ambitious in the world as far as coverage and a whole range of measures. And my view is that that's gone probably too far as actually not then thinking about all the complementary measures you need to offset all the political compromise you have to make in that scheme design. And we see it in terms of households get money instead of actually incentives to reduce emissions through demand side management or putting a price cap of $40 and all the whole range of things, which of course are necessary to get through the Senate and it's of course necessary to get that political buy-in. And so I think as long as you recognise that, and as you said, I think Tom made the point, you don't want those things to hang around, you don't want those compromises to be there in 5 years' time when you start to ratchet up the targets. So there's a question whether that they can be taken away in the long run. And so I think that's really the issue. That I think the failing has been that because of that political process, complementary measures has been totally ignored, and I think that's the issue.
Okay, Merrick, I'm going to take two more comments because otherwise we'll miss lunch. Regina, very briefly, and then this question.
Just very quickly on what Paul said. The other thing is if you have a very broad coverage, every complementarity measure reduction is just going to be under the cap, so to hit. So it's not going to be an additional thing, what you can see. So there's no incentive for the government to do really complementary measures in the current sector. So that's another problem of covering everything. And as I mentioned before, a loose target or weak target with a broad coverage might be very inefficient. But the other thing is, I wanted to go back to your point. Having kind of a very high criticism of one's scheme design at the very beginning proved quite good in the European context. They were a 3-year pilot phase. They learned quite a drastic lessons with a high windfall profits, the over allocation, all that. But you know, it was a pilot phase, it was a short time period, and it now got them to actually reduce and address these problems. And in Australia, with 10 years of fixed targets and all these kind of things, I believe we don't have the time to learn.
That's part of the problem, in my view. The scheme is designed with all these lock-in features to provide long-term certainty, that it isn't conducive to learning and building. It almost makes it very hard to ratchet it up down the track and puts a lot of liability on the taxpayer.
Thank you. My name is Trish Harris. I'm from Greenpeace. I slightly for Stephen. It's about the analysis of CERs from CDM, from the Clean Development Mechanism, into the Australian scheme, and what that means for the environmental integrity of our scheme. There's a lot of questions and criticisms around CDM, but particularly around the additionality test. That is, whether any project or analysis would suggest that a large or significant number of CDM projects aren't truly additional. And therefore, have you looked at what that will mean for the environmental integrity, and is there any measures to try and combat that? Because I don't think it's happening yet through the COP-MOP process.
Yeah. Can we take that mainly as a comment, a 30-second response, if you'd like?
Yeah, well, a quick response is in two parts. One is the scheme is designed to deliver on our international obligations. So as the international obligations improve, i.e. the quality of Asian crews, we get there. The other thing is just to observe that the big modelling projects about getting to somewhere worthwhile are not consistent with the discussions in the current round of international negotiations. They're assuming a fundamental evolution of CDM to something that is much has lower transaction costs but also delivers much more genuine value.
Okay, now Frank, one very final.
Very quick response to your point about the stiff targets, just to reiterate the point of taking on minus 25 or more would not kind of throw the Australian economy into the abyss because it wouldn't really change the price that we're facing at the margin. And just to sort of board overall comment, I think the big disconnect, and I think we saw that really in that December, the really strong protests about the target range and all of that. The question is this a normal exercise in policy making, right? And along those yardsticks, probably have to argue that it's been fairly successful so far. Or are we looking as a society for something truly transformational because we're facing the climate change emergency, in which case, of course, just about any of your responses that you see anywhere falls short of the mark.
Okay. I'm terribly sorry to do this. The rock started with me as the first chair. We ran out of time right there and then. Some of you had questions that you haven't been able to ask. I do apologise. We have failed you in that regard. Could you please join me in thanking Frank and the panel for what I'm going to ask is that the panel all come and have a sandwich or two so you can grab the person you didn't get a chance to get your question to and get them over food. Thank you all very much for coming. A challenging time to be thinking.